This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the situation is very serious because we are now at the second or third successive drought, and the rains this year basically have failed in the regions that are in the pastoral area. So we're talking about mostly about the Somali region and also some other regions.
That's Abdul Karim Ba, FAO's deputy representative for Ethiopia. Details coming up.
Also, Chad, Libya, and Somalia are the African countries on President Trump's new travel ban order. And a 25-year-old suspect originally from South Sudan has confessed to a deadly church shooting near the U.S. city of Nashville.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, President Trump has signed a new travel ban order placing restrictions on citizens from Chad, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, and North Korea. The order also blocks entry into the U.S. by some Venezuelan government officials. The administration says the new restrictions will help keep the U.S. safe. It says the affected countries have refused to share information about terrorism and other issues. The new order was announced as a 90-day travel ban affecting six mostly Muslim countries was expiring. The new rules take effect on October 18th.
Nigerian authorities say three police officers were killed last evening in an attack on a zoo in southern Nigeria. AFP reports the brother of a local government minister was also kidnapped. Police say gunmen attacked the Ogba Zoological Gardens and Nature Park in Benin City around 6 p.m. yesterday. They say Dr. Andy Ihanira, brother of the Benin State Health Minister, was abducted. He's the zoo's director. Authorities suspect he's being held for ransom.
Police say a 25-year-old suspect has confessed to a deadly church shooting near the city of Nashville in the southern U.S. state of Tennessee. One person was killed and six wounded. Emmanuel Kadega Sampson is expected to appear in court tomorrow. Sampson came to the U.S. from what is now South Sudan 2 decades ago and is a legal resident but not a U.S. citizen. Nashville police spokesman Don Aaron says a man at the church stopped the attack.
There was a church usher who confronted the gunman. During the confrontation, the church usher was pistol whipped. There was a significant struggle between the two. During the struggle, the gunman shot himself, probably not intentionally, in the left pectoral muscle, in the left chest.
Sampson is charged with first-degree murder. He reportedly had attended the church in the past. Investigators have not given a possible motive for shooting.
Three UN peacekeepers were killed yesterday in Mali when their vehicle struck a roadside bomb or landmine. Five other soldiers were wounded in the attack. It happened in northern Mali, along a road between the city of Gao and Anifis village. The peacekeepers who were killed and wounded were all from Bangladesh. Violence continues in northern Mali despite a 2015 peace deal with armed groups.
In Ethiopia, drought has hit cattle herders in the southern and southeastern regions hard, decimating livestock and leaving families without livelihoods. It's also caused rising malnutrition. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says about 8.5 million people are hungry, with about half concentrated in the Somali region. Abdul Karim Ba is the FAO's deputy representative for Ethiopia. Reporter William Eagle asked him to describe current conditions in drought-stricken areas.
The situation is very serious because we are now at the second or third successive drought, and the rains this year basically have failed in the regions that are in the pastoral area. So we're talking about mostly about the Somali region and also some other regions in Ethiopia. And so basically the rains have failed. So there was no way for the pastures to regenerate. So basically there is no food, there is no animal feed, there are no pastures. So herders are losing quite a lot of their animals. I was in the Somali region, in Warder and also in Kokorae zones. And when you get there, you don't feel that there is a crisis, because if you go to the main towns, you see that the markets are quite fine. You go to the restaurants, you have the food. You see here and there some IDP settlements, etc. Security is there. You can move freely around, so there is no problem of access. So when you're there, you don't really feel that there is a crisis. The problem is what you don't see. And what you don't see are animals. There is very, very small number of livestock that you see here and there, mostly around water points. And when you talk to the people, this is what they're going to tell you, that they have lost all of their animals. You speak to people who had 300 heads of livestock a few months ago, and now they have none. So they had to move to go to IDP camps, etc. So the situation is quite dire.
Karim, what steps is the FAO taking to prevent further livestock losses?
What needs to be done is to provide emergency feeds to livestock, to the core breeding animals, provide animal health services, and the third one is to destock, so destocking. With all the resources that we have and that we are planning to receive from now till the end of the year, we will be able to target only 10% of the total core breeding animals that we should target to prevent a further deterioration of the situation. So the situation is dire. The resources to respond adequately are quite low. So we really need more funds, more resources to come. I think it was an additional $20 million that would be needed in 2017 to address the situation.
The press release mentioned improving fodder and feed production and also rehabilitating water points. With the drought continuing, how is it possible to improve fodder and feed production, or even to rehabilitate water points? Would this not depend on rains, on water?
Absolutely. It's a question to improve the water management. So looking at 2018, 2019, etc., actions need to be taken now so that we can increase the fodder production locally so that the fodder is there when it's needed. And this means engaging with the private sector and making sure that we have, for example, fodder in the form of multi-nutrient blocks or pellets that can be produced when there is availability of local material and they can be stored for a longer period of time, for example. And regarding water, yes, this is something that needs to be done also with other sectors, and UNICEF is very active in there, the WASH, where water points, boreholes, etc. are being rehabilitated. So we have to work closely together with other sectors to make sure, at least for the water, that where actions are taken for human water, also animals can have access to it. And regarding fodder, this is what I was saying before. So engaging with the private sector and making sure that fodder can be produced locally. Also with spate irrigation schemes, where when there are rains in some areas, you have these seasonal rivers that just for a few hours, you have a lot of water, some torrential water that passes through. So there are ways to capture this water, to divert it and use it for other production, vegetable production, etc.
The FAO is also supporting destocking and cash for work programs. What is destocking?
Regarding destocking, so basically this means to decrease the number of livestock heads of a herd before the crisis hits. So basically, you have to go to the herders, the pastoralists, and tell them, listen, you have so many animals, there will be a drought, there will be not enough food to feed all the animals, so let's take a few of them out. And you can do either slaughter destocking or commercial destocking. So slaughter destocking would mean to take the animals out, slaughter them, and give the meat for food to the population. Or to take the animals out of the herd, and we don't slaughter them, but we bring them in areas where they can be fattened, etc., and then slaughter them later or sell them later. So basically, this is destocking. It's just to reduce the size of herds to make them more manageable with the feed that is available.
That was Abdul Karim Ba, the deputy representative for the Food and Agriculture Organization for Ethiopia. He spoke with reporter William Eagle.
Fierce debate continues in Uganda over the ruling party's plans to try to remove the presidential age limit from the constitution. Parliament is again expected to take up the issue this week, with the opposition pledging to continue its resistance. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
Uganda's ruling party says it will push ahead with its plans to scrap the presidential age limit despite street protests and stiff resistance from opposition lawmakers last week. Peter Ogwang is vice chairperson of the ruling party caucus in parliament.
It's provided for in this constitution of the Republic of Uganda. What are we doing? We are using the law which were made by the delegates in 1995 with the law which we have been using to amend provisions of this constitution. So I'm within the law.
Uganda's constitution sets the presidential age limit at 75. That means long-time president Yoweri Museveni would not be eligible to run in the next elections in 2021. Critics of the age limit say it is discriminatory. Proponents say the age limit was implemented to promote the peaceful, democratic transfer of power, something that Uganda has not experienced since independence in 1962. The opposition is showing no signs of backing down. VOA spoke to opposition leader and four-time presidential candidate Kizza Besigye.
It's not about the principle of age as to whether, you know, a 75-year-old cannot be president or not. That is vital in this consideration. It is whether it can check the presidency of Mr. Museveni, who ascended to power through force of arms and has stayed in power with the assistance of the military rather than the free will of the people of Uganda.
The opposition and international human rights groups accuse the government of using security forces to squash dissent. At least 28 university students were arrested during protests on September 21st, according to the Observatory for the Protection of Human Rights Defenders. The opposition says several lawmakers have also been prevented from leaving their homes or detained.
They tore my clothes, they lifted me high, they kicked me, they harangued me.
That's Erias Lukwago, the Lord Mayor of Kampala, who was arrested on September 18th, accused of trying to organize a protest against lifting the age limit.
They all grabbed me and dumped me in a waiting truck because they had come with a van. I think it is a custom-made van intended for that particular purpose. It looks like these trucks normally used to carry hound dogs.
As Parliament prepares to reopen Tuesday, the opposition has called on Ugandans to wear red as a form of silent protest. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehis Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Chad, Libya, and Somalia are three of the African countries on President Trump's new travel ban order. Nigerian authorities say three police officers were killed last evening in an attack on a zoo in southern Nigeria. And three UN peacekeepers were killed yesterday in Mali when their vehicle struck a roadside bomb. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
An outspoken Zimbabwe pastor has found himself in court once again after posting a video on the internet about the country's poor economy. Evan Mawarire is the founder of the movement #ThisFlag. In his video, he said Zimbabwe is facing shortages in many areas and described the situation as very urgent. Reporter Peter Thornycroft is following developments from Johannesburg. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the pastor.
Pastor Evan Mawarire has been arrested more than any other so-called opposition person in recent years. And it's extraordinary because he doesn't hold demonstrations. All he does is put out some videos on his phone and preach to people in a small suburb in Harare. And all he does is say, we're short of cash. You know, he doesn't want anyone to join an opposition political party or anything like that. It's because they are so sensitive about the financial situation of Zimbabwe, where there is no cash in the bank. I really don't understand what it is that the ZANU-PF government fears about Evan Mawarere.
Well, let me ask you about that. What are the charges against him this time?
That he is threatening to overthrow a constitutionally elected government.
How?
By making statements about the economy, which they say threaten the economy. How he did this was he put out a video under his This Flag hashtag, which people with social media, and that's the minority of people in Zimbabwe, only people in urban areas have got smartphones and can listen to what he says. And the one he did yesterday when he was arrested was he was standing in front of a fuel queue, because suddenly fuel has become short in Zimbabwe because there is very little foreign cash to buy fuel or to pay for imported electricity or to pay for imported goods. And so the black market in the so-called currencies is growing. Zimbabwe doesn't have its own currency. That was abandoned in 2008 in the previous crisis. It uses the US dollar, which has disappeared, and has created a new currency called bond notes, or it buys and sells using electronic money, or as some people call it, the phantom currency. So there is another financial crisis in Zimbabwe, and Pastor Evan Mawarere sends out messages saying this, that the government will not tolerate it.
Now, he's faced serious charges before. How serious are these charges, and what are his chances of getting off?
The charges he faces carry a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison. Any logical lawyer in Harare would tell you the government has no way of making any of these charges stick. But Zimbabwe isn't always following the rule of law. The legal system is also used to terrify people or to restrict people. In theory, there is no way to prove it, but no lawyer will tell you today in Harare that he will be acquitted or the charges will be dropped or that this is just harassment. They simply don't know.
What has been the reaction of the U.S. Embassy in Harare to his arrest?
The U.S. Embassy in Harare has issued a warning. It is watching this case. Evan Mawarere has somehow found a popularity that is surprising considering no one knew him until last year. And the U.S. Embassy has warned the Zimbabwe government about freedom of association and the rule of law in a statement, which it hasn't made for quite some time now.
That's reporter Peter Thornycroft from Johannesburg. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Following the 1994 Rwanda genocide, the country's economy and infrastructure were in a state of collapse. Since then, the economy has shown startling growth of between 6 and 9% every year. One engine driving the growth has been a sustained government effort to improve communications and information technology in both rural and urban areas. VOA's Adam Phillips has been covering the opening of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. He interviewed Jean Gebare Nusengimunu, Rwanda's Minister of Communications, Information and Technology and Youth. He first explained what his government is doing to create a globally connected Rwanda.
Information communication technology is part and parcel of our infrastructure for development, whether you talk about the social sectors such as education, healthcare, trade, government service delivery. And my job as part of the government of Rwanda is to make sure that every Rwandan is connected to basic telecommunication services, phone calls and messages, but also broadband, being able to communicate using the internet the best way possible.
Tell me about connectivity and education. How do those go together?
Connectivity is now part and parcel of education.
Mean the children have computers?
Not all of the children, that's what you would like to see, but not all of them because, you know, incomes are what they are today. Today we are looking at least equipping a lab in every primary and secondary school so that technology is not only demystified, but it can be used effectively to deliver a quality of education that our teachers may not be able to deliver, the quality of content that we are not able to develop yet, but that is already developed and available out there online.
Do you have training to teach people how to sort of write code and do computer work and computer science and that kind of thing, or do they all go abroad to learn that?
No, I mean, we are shifting from just being consumers, so we've got startups out there. Some of them have already gone international, and with things like 3D printing, drone technology, virtual reality, this is where our young people are.
What is IT's application to health in your country?
There are two sides to that. One is the public health side, where the public health authorities, the ministries, those who dispense health care, are able to measure, to deliver their work more effectively by, for instance, tracking epidemics. So you have an integrated surveillance system so that you can catch even one single case of cholera and respond immediately before it becomes an epidemic. We have even advanced algorithm to be able to detect and anticipate, for instance, malaria, where you know that there is a combination of temperature, of water, of rainfall, of a neighboring country that is facing a certain problem. You can predict that if nothing is done, that problem is going to spread to Rwanda, so we can prevent that kind of spread. HIV/AIDS is another example where we use IT to track each and every case to make sure that people who are on medication are adhering on medication, that we don't run out of drugs and so on.
I heard you mention earlier in the evening that the consumer-driven approach is the second prong of your health strategy vis-a-vis IT. Would you please explain what that is?
The consumer-driven is to put the life of everyone in their own hands, especially using mobile applications which can educate, for instance, in the areas of reproductive health, where people are really on top of their own reproductive health by having information on their cycle or which drugs to take and so on. For mothers and girls, for instance, to be able to time and register. So you register on a service with a very simple short code that my cycle starts on this day, and the application can be guiding you throughout the month on which period you need to abstain from sex or do protect sex and so on. If it's a pregnancy, for instance, you can register based on a consultation, the cycle of your pregnancy, and the application can be giving you information on which drugs to take, on which visits to go to the doctor, on nutrition. So that is the consumer-driven IT health applications that is really helping to improve behaviors and do a lot in terms of prevention.
You're very, very ambitious. I mean, it seems to me that of all the ministries, the IT seems to be the most holistic in the sense that it touches every area of life.
That is true. And part of what we do is to sensitize and educate and teach them how they should be applying IT to whatever their job is. The moment somebody becomes digital literate, it's a new world of opportunity that you've opened to that person. Mm-hmm. So we feel the sense of urgency of not leaving anyone behind.
And that was Jean-Guibert Nusengemunu, Rwanda's Minister of Communications, Information, Technology and Youth. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
OPEC is expected to decide in November whether to extend production cuts that have boosted oil prices. Oil exporting countries may also decide whether to impose output quotas. Last year, OPEC and non-OPEC nations reached a deal to reduce output, causing prices to stabilize around $55 a barrel. The OPEC meeting will be held in Vienna.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And on behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000.